We're almost finished with the seventh chapter of Daniel, even though I think probably we were looking at about verse 11. This is a throne scene because the fourth beast in chapter 7 represents the Roman Empire, and there was a little horn that came out of the Roman Empire representing the papal dynasty. We've seen how it wore out the saints of the Most High. It spake great swelling words, and this dominance was going to continue for 1260 years. And then after that time, there is a waning. There is a judgment upon this entity. And we were in the middle, as I recall, we were in the middle of talking about that the last time that we were together. We have a throne scene similar to what we have in Isaiah 6 and Ezekiel 1 and in Revelation 4. And it's just the judgment on Rome described in apocalyptic language. Very similar to Revelation 19:20, where the beast and the false prophet are judged. We're talking about institutions and not individuals here. The temporal papal empire and its supporter are ended as beast. I think that's the point of this section of Daniel chapter 7. Not the final judgment of individuals. The temporal papal empire is ended as a beast. So when Daniel sees the fourth beast, this is more fully developed when John sees this fourth beast in the book of Revelation chapter 13. John sees two beasts. Did we talk about this? I don't think we did. This little horn that John sees here 700 years before Christ in the book of Daniel is more fully developed in the book of Revelation when John sees 100 years after Christ a fuller picture. It's kind of like when astronomers are using telescopes, and when they started using telescopes to look at the stars, sometimes they would see a single star, or they thought it was. But later, when more powerful telescopes were made, they would see that what looked like a single star was now seen to be a binary star, two stars circling each other. So writing 700 years later than Daniel, the Apostle John was given a more powerful prophetic telescope showing more detail. In chapter 19, the beast and the false prophet, the beast and the false prophet are cast into the lake of fire. And even though we don't have the final judgment of individuals until the end of chapter 20 in the book of Revelation at the great white throne, that's the final judgment scene that Jesus described in the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew with the sheep on the right hand and the goats on the left. But here he's talking about the judgment of institutions. Because there are only two kinds of kingdoms. He says, let me read verse 12. As concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. The rest of the beast, the bear, the lion and the leopard, had their influence carried on in Rome. Civilization doesn't die, it migrates. It proceeds on from one to the other. And these are symbolized in Revelation 13 as the lion, the bear, and the leopard as well, because the fourth beast has the characteristics of each of these plus some more. Ultimately, there are only these two kinds of kingdoms. There's the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. Just as Jesus operates through us, his voluntary followers, so Satan operates through his followers. There was a time when, shortly after his baptism, Satan showed Jesus all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them in a moment of time and said, "All these things will I give you if you'll fall down and worship me." That's in Matthew chapter 4. Luke puts the words of Jesus this way: "All this power I will give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will, I give it." Luke chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. And Jesus never contradicted that. The kingdoms of this world belong to Satan, and he works through them. So the kingdoms of this earth operate on a basic philosophy, and that is called political expediency. The idea behind it is power. Might makes right. We see this all the time in the world. It's only the Lord's kingdom, that functions according to the opposite principle, and that is right makes might. That's the idea that if God be for us, who can be against us? No matter what the numerical odds are, Gideon's army of 300 is able to defeat whoever God wants it to defeat. He took it down from 32,000 to 300 to make that point. So be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. That's our watchword in the kingdom of God. The kingdoms of earth pass away one by one, but the kingdom of heaven remains. And as the earthly kingdoms pass away one by one, they pass on their accumulated civilization to those who come after them. As I said, and this was a quote from Will Durant in his 11-volume story of civilization, civilization doesn't die, it migrates, because each dying kingdom is perpetuated in spirit by those that come after them. The nations that enslaved and persecuted the people of God were all used by Satan for that purpose as allowed by God. And as they passed from the scene one by one, each was perpetuated in the spirit in the next. And they each had their dominion taken away, and yet that was never yet the end of time. Their influence persisted on the passing human scene. But the final judgment, of course, awaits the people in those nations as well. So we have here in this passage a contrast between the false, the little horn that we've been talking about, and the true, the kingdom of Christ. The kingdom of Christ, the bride of Christ, modest and meek and retiring, and the great whore, as it's called in the book of Revelation. This shows the contrast here. I'll read verses 13 and 14. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. So what we're talking about here in verse 14 is chapter 2, verse 44. This kingdom, this little stone cut out of the mountainside without hand that hits the great image and knocks it to pieces, is the kingdom of Christ, which shall never pass away. It shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall never pass away. Daniel 2:44. That's the idea here. It shall stand forever and not be destroyed. Down in verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. He says, I, Daniel. The writer here claims to be Daniel. If he lied, and this was really written hundreds of years after Daniel, then he fooled Jesus Christ, because Jesus said that Daniel wrote this in Matthew 24, verse 15. But the prophets received visions that they often did not understand. Daniel, seeing this vision, he's seeing it happen, and he's writing it down in words, what he's visually seeing occur. But that doesn't mean that he understands it, as the Apostle Peter put it. These prophets were searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when he testified aforehand the glory that should come, the glory that should follow after the sufferings of Christ. The saints are going to possess the kingdom forever. And after all the variations and fluctuations of rule and dominion among men, there was finally going to come a kingdom which is permanent because it's perfect, and that's the one that we're in. Yes, it was established on the day of Pentecost, in the year that Jesus was crucified and resurrected, but here in Daniel 7, we're reading about its vindication. Here, the church is coming out of the wilderness that we see it go into in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation. Now, sometimes it does not appear, does it, that the saints possess the kingdom. But appearances don't always matter. What is truth and reality is what matters. And this has always been true with the people of God. Things were not as they appeared because God was behind the scenes keeping watch above his own. It didn't matter, for example, that the Pharaoh in Exodus looked as though he was succeeding in frustrating God's purposes. Here he was enslaving God's people. He was killing their babies. And it looked like the Pharaoh had everything going for him. But that same Pharaoh still sheltered and fed and educated and protected the only baby boy he needed to kill, who was called Moses. That was the one he needed to kill, but he didn't kill him. Instead, he protected and raised him right in his own palace. No matter, don't wonder that Scripture says, he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. God must have gotten a kick out of that. You're killing all these other babies, but the one I'm going to defeat you with is living in your own house, and you don't even realize it. In this sense, the kingdom of the Messiah will never be destroyed. And as heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, we share in that. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and as heirs of God, we share in that. No matter what the world thinks, what Paul said to the Corinthians is true in 1 Corinthians 3, verses 21 and 23. All things are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. So this passage is showing a public demonstration of the sovereignty of God. We were talking a little, some of us, about the sovereignty of God before we started tonight. This is a public demonstration of the sovereignty of God, and God allows Satan and his kingdoms to operate within certain limits, but not outside of those limits. This is, in verse 14, not the beginning of Christ's reign, but a demonstration of Christ's reign. Just as back in chapter 4, the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar for 7 years served a similar purpose to this. And that was to make it publicly known that, as Nebuchadnezzar said 3 times in chapter 4, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. The Most High rules already in the kingdoms of men, even when Nebuchadnezzar was so proud he couldn't see it. Satan has power? Yes. But God has limits beyond which he will not allow Satan to go. He got the whole world in his hands. That's really true. The Lord's judgments, by the way, are often described as comings. There have been many comings of the Lord in this sense. Now, there are only 2 appearances of Christ. There was an appearance of Christ 2,000 years ago when he walked this earth in the flesh, and there's going to be another appearance of Christ at the end of time, as depicted in Hebrews 9, when the writer just flatly says, he shall appear a second time. And that one hasn't happened yet. But every appearance of the Lord is a coming of the Lord, but not every coming of the Lord is an appearance of the Lord. There are many comings of the Lord. For instance, the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD was a coming of the Lord. And so the destruction of the temporal empire of the little horn was a coming of the Lord in that sense. So the text here presupposes but doesn't directly deal with Pentecost. The reception of the kingdom here is not speaking about the establishment of the kingdom. It's talking about the public manifestation of God's sovereignty in his kingdom. In Revelation 1:9, for example, John makes it clear that the kingdom has already been established at the time that he wrote, and he said that I'm in it. I'm your fellow servant in the kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ. He was already in the kingdom at that time. But then in chapter 11, verse 15 of Revelation, he speaks of the kingdoms of this world becoming the kingdoms of our Lord and his Christ. Well, didn't the kingdom already belong to Christ? Yes. But this was a vindication of the sovereignty of Christ. The kingdom is often publicly manifested, and when it is, the kingdom comes in that sense. So when the Lord renders a judgment in favor of his people, as he does in this 7th chapter, over this little horn after 1260 years, and he's just saying that the kingdom is theirs, it belongs to my people. It's not the establishment of the kingdom at Pentecost, but the public demonstration of the already existing kingdom that the Lord exercised on behalf of his saints. We have this kind of terminology used many times in the Bible. For example, in the book of Obadiah. Did you just recently study the book of Obadiah? Okay, it's been a while back. Well, anyway, in the book of Obadiah, Edom was told that she would be judged by God and that at the time of that judgment, the kingdom shall be Jehovah's. But the kingdom was already Jehovah's. The judgment on Edom was just going to publicly prove that the kingdom belonged to the Lord. It already belonged to the Lord. And that's the kind of terminology that's used here. So the Lord did indeed come in judgment on the persecutor of God's people. The judgment against the little horn, just for context here, taking a little broader view of this chapter, verse 10 says that the judgment was set, and then verse 26 says that the judgment shall sit. The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. This is the gradual disintegration of the papal system, which we are observing in our own time. They've still got the trappings. When one pope dies, they have a conclave and they pick another pope. And then, as one of the coins from a few hundred years ago said, whom they create, they adore. It said it in Latin, but translated to English, that's what this coin says. Whom they create, they adore. These cardinals will go into conclave and they will create a new pope in a couple of weeks or so. And then they will adore him as the Holy Father, who is infallible some of the time. It's really kind of an amazing system. And we're observing the disintegration. They still use the same terminology. They still keep the same trappings. But that system has lost its temporal power. And I believe we'll never regain it. We've talked a little bit about the sexual scandals of the priest with children that have cost that system untold millions of dollars to those families and cost the system millions of members. And their problems continue to accumulate. They're really not getting any better. But that system will exist until the end of time to be destroyed by the brightness of the Lord's final coming, his second appearance, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. I'm sorry to have to say to you that this is a putrid system. I wouldn't be fully expressing the truth if I didn't just say that. It's a system that is rotten to the core. The Pope is basically a politician, and he thinks and behaves like a politician. And it's a system that I encounter very frequently, and it's just sad. I'll give you one example. And I don't know if I've told you this or not before, but it was striking to me. I was up in Chicago one time, and there was a lady in the congregation that I was working with. She said, I wish you would talk to my friend. She's involved with Roman Catholicism. So I went over to that lady's house one afternoon and spent 2 hours talking with her, had a good conversation. When I got up to leave at the end of our discussion, she said, what do I owe you? I said, what do you mean? She said, well, when I talk to the priest, I have to pay. And I thought, oh, you poor, sad little lady. It's just really too bad that people get enmeshed in this. A lot of nice, good people are enmeshed in this system and just never really tried to figure out what the actual authority in religion is. And if we're looking to the Bible, you know, you can give lip service to looking to the Bible. I heard a priest on TV after the Pope died saying, we need to get back to what the apostle said. Well, when did they ever talk about a pope? But you're getting ready to elect a new one. So yeah, do get back to what the apostle said. Do what you just said you need. But it's not going to happen. This system will exist until the end, if I understand 2 Thessalonians 2 correctly. Once these systems get rolling, the snowball gets too big and nothing's ever going to stop it. But you can come out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing. That's what we need. Now, I can read the rest of this chapter, but I'll read a little farther here just to get the, but we've already talked about it is my point. We talked about it as it was occurring, and now Daniel is saying, what was that? What was that all about? And so it's explained a little more, but we've already looked at all the rest of this, I think. I'll go ahead and read it just for the sake of closure, I guess. Daniel was troubled over this. I came near unto one of them that stood by, this would be an angelic being, and asked him the truth of all this, and he told me, and made me to know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts which are four kings or kingdoms, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails were brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns which were in his hand, and these were the 10 tribes of Europe, which became the 10 nations of Europe, and I gave you slides that had 10 of each of those, as you may recall. And of the other which came up, the little horn, before whom 3 fell, even of the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. That's the little horn we've been talking about now for probably more than 1 week, probably the better part of a couple of weeks. And I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints. We've talked about that. He prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given unto the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings, or kingdoms, that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and shall subdue three kings. And we talked about which three tribes those were, and which three nations of Europe those were earlier, and had it on the slides. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and a dividing of time, 1260 years, as we talked about last week. But the judgment shall sit, and that's why I think he will never regain his temporal power again. The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. That's that gradual disintegration that we're seeing in our own time. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Which kind of reminds me of Mary's experiences with the angel Gabriel and all that transpired there. She kept these matters in her heart, so that when Luke came along later and interviewed her, she gave her information to Luke, and he wrote it down in the book of Luke. Daniel is keeping these things in his heart, and he writes down what the Lord wanted him to write down for us. Any other question, comment, or thought on chapter 7? Ed.
I think we can also see this in Europe today. At one time, the papacy and those 10 kingdoms ruled the earth. At one time, Spain and Portugal split the world in two spheres of influence.
Right.
But now, where is their power? They've been subdued. There hasn't... You know, nobody looks to Germany or France or Spain or Italy for protection because they are basically powerless.
Right.
And then also the Reformation churches that started, they also wore the saints out.
Right.
And look at them now. The papacy is nothing. Spain has no influence over God's people. None of these do. That's remarkable for me. And the kingdom of heaven shall stand. But one thing I've always wondered is, how about the Oriental peoples? You know, mostly we're talking about Europe, the Mediterranean world and beyond, but I've always been interested, were there prophets sent to them? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. We have very little information about that. But we do know that the Inquisition, for example, deemed itself a global institution. And they had representatives in the Asian countries, Japan, for example, and on the ships at sea that were trading back and forth. So at least they deemed themselves to be in charge of it all. That was the way they viewed it. And the point you make about Spain and Portugal is very important because it does carry over to our own part of the world. They were the first explorers here, and they took over these nations for their kingdoms back home. Spain and Portugal were the European nations, along with Great Britain, that were closest to the New World. And so they came from there, and the Pope was still very much in power, very much involved, and he's the one that drew the line of demarcation on South America. Who's between Spain and Portugal, who's going to get South America? Well, the Pope was trying to draw a line just right down through the middle of it. Part would go to Spain and part would go to Portugal, but being infallible, he got confused. He hadn't been made infallible yet, I'll say that for him. He wasn't made infallible until 1870. So he got confused and drew the line in the wrong place, and all Portugal got was the edge of Brazil, you know, that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean, and Spain got everything else. And that's why Portuguese is the official language of Brazil today, and the official language of the other South American countries is Spanish, because the Pope drew the line in the wrong place. few things like that, and you start to wonder, well, does he really have power? And today, yeah, go ahead, Ed.
Another thing about that is, where is the power of all these Catholic countries?
Right.
They're poor.
Yeah.
Downtrodden.
They are. Yeah, you go into a, and I hate to even go into this, but I feel like the truth necessitates it to some extent. You go into a nation that has been dominated by that system. I don't care if it's Mexico or the Philippines. By the way, you get in downtown Mexico City, good luck trying to tell it apart from downtown Manila in the Philippines. It's the same thing. And they're still dominated by this system. And there is just so much governmental corruption. That's their biggest problem by far. You think we've got governmental corruption in our country, and we certainly do. But we make these other countries look lily white by comparison. And even though that power has been lost, it's still attempting to be exercised. Just right before the inauguration that we had in January, the Pope, Francis, moved a man from San Diego, moved him to Washington, D.C. to fight President Trump. Did you know that? No. Nobody knows it because it doesn't matter. There's no power there at all, and so it's just ridiculous. But he still did it. That's the thing that interests me. He still did it because he's still in there trying to grasp that power back as much as he possibly can. You guys are doing good. Other questions, comments, or thoughts? Yeah, Ed?
Just for me, it's hard for me to give a vote to a Catholic or a Mormon because where is their thinking?
Yeah.
And they make great boasts about their faith and so forth, but they're so far off the tracks that and that's not to say in the others who are non-religious are much better, but I mean, I definitely know that if they agree with those two doctrines, they're not very smart.
Yeah,
to be honest.
The thing is, usually, when a Roman Catholic runs for the presidency in our country, they're not really sold on the idea of their own Catholic religion. We've seen an evolution of that over time, over the past 80, 90 years or so. When Al Smith, or almost 100 years, when Al Smith ran, was it in 1928? I think so. Al Smith ran, and because he was a Catholic, he lost. In 1960, when John Kennedy ran, because he was a Catholic, there was a lot of controversy over his running. And there were public debates about this. He was publicly questioned about this. You're a Roman Catholic. Doesn't that mean your first allegiance is to Rome and to the Pope? And I remember President Kennedy saying that he didn't understand the question, and then they slid on to some other question. But so he never really had to answer that in any substantial way. They didn't follow up on it. But he still won. From 1928 to 1960, there had been a change take place so that he could win. He was a television president just starting into that. When Joe Biden, also a Catholic, ran for the office, his Catholicism was hardly mentioned. Now, in the case of Kennedy and Biden, I don't think they really believe in what they purport to believe. They don't act like they do. They don't talk like they do. So it's a good thing that they don't, I guess, think that their allegiance should be to Rome. But yes, it is a strange thing, the evolution we've seen over time. From 1928 to 2020, it was a big deal 100 years ago, and now it doesn't seem to be a big deal to hardly anybody. Interesting point. Thank you. You guys do very well with this. Anything else? Yeah, Lynn?
Did you say the Pope became infallible?
1870. He wanted to be infallible all the time, but they backed him down to where he could only be infallible when speaking ex cathedra, that is, from the chair. Interestingly, when Alexander Campbell debated Bishop Purcell, who was a Roman Catholic, Campbell made some really good points and drove them home well. And when it came time to vote on the infallibility of the Pope, Bishop Purcell was one of, I believe, only two votes against the infallibility of the Pope, because he had experienced Alexander Campbell. At least I like to think that that was the reason for his negative vote on that. That was in 1870, yes. And we'll have occasion in chapter 12 to talk a little more about this system, because I think we have some further detail given to us there. Anything else? Okay. I think we're ready to move on then to chapter 8. And again, if you think of something later, we can always go back. Here we have a new vision and a new part of the subject. It's all the same subject, really. What's going to happen in the future? And these four empires that we saw in chapter 2 and chapter 7 are still in play here. But two of them in particular are in play in this chapter. I'll read verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. Third year of Belshazzar would be the year 551 to 550 B.C., just as we're now in the school year, 2024-2025. So in that 1 year period of time there, that overlaps into two of our years. The vision at the first is the one that we saw in chapter 7. When this prophecy was given to Daniel, nobody in the ancient world could have possibly thought that within two decades, the mighty Neo-Babylonian Empire was going to fall. And nobody could have possibly thought that Persia or Greece or Rome were going to emerge as world-dominating influences. That would have just been outside of the thinking of most people because of their relative weakness at the time. Verse 2, I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Now in verse 2 here, Shushan is the same as the city of Susa. It's better known by the name of Susa. This is 160 miles east of the Tigris River, and it became one of the four capitals of the Persian Empire after it was defeated and after its conquest by King Cyrus of the Persians. So this became one of the four capitals. They had four places that the kings lived. They circulated around those depending on the climate, primarily. There were some political considerations, but they didn't have any air conditioning that was anything to write home about. And we're talking about a desert area. So they would move around among these four palaces, primarily depending, I think, upon the weather. Here we have Elam mentioned, but that's just an earlier name for Persia. Today we talk about Iran. Persia is an earlier name for Iran in our time. It became Iran in 1935. So it's Elam or Persia or Iran, but for our purposes it's all the same basic piece of real estate and the same basic country. The Ulai is part of the Tigris-Euphrates river system. This is a river near Susa that flowed down and became part of that river system. Verse 3, I lifted mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. So we see, Daniel sees here, and maybe I better read the next one. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Daniel sees a ram here. We don't have to guess what it symbolizes because in verse 20, again, we're told. In the latter part of this chapter, we have the interpretation of what we're seeing in the early part of the chapter. The ram which thou sawest, verse 20, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, as we call it. I like it when we don't have to guess about what the interpretation is. This is like the parable of the sower in Matthew 13. Jesus gave the parable, and then he went back and explained it. Point by point, the field is the world and so forth. So you don't have to guess about it because the same source of authority that gave you the original information is now giving you the interpretation. This ram has two horns. They're both high. They're both powerful. But one is higher than the other. One is more powerful than the other. Remember in chapter 7, we saw this same empire under the figure of a bear. And the bear was raised up on one side, and we said that's the Persian because that's the more powerful. And the same thing is true here. The higher one is Persia because it's the more powerful. And the other side, the lower one, would be the Medes. The Medes were the older kingdom. The Persians were the newer kingdom. The higher came up last is because the Persian was the newer of the two. And he pressed. He started to press in imperialistic warfare. He went westward. This took him to conquer Babylon. As we saw, Babylon was one of the first places, one of the first three places that it was declared as three ribs in the symbolism we saw in chapter 7, three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. So Babylon, Medo-Persia, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Syria, and Asia Minor were in the westward push. And then in the northward, Armenia, the Caspian Sea area, and the area of Iberia. And finally, the southward into Ethiopia, Egypt, Libya, and Israel, which is going to become very important. The Medo-Persian Empire took over the area of Israel until eventually, in the days of Esther, remember Esther chapter 1, verse 1, the Medo-Persian Empire had 127 provinces from Ethiopia to India. That's right in the text of Esther chapter 1, verse 1. And we're told here in verse 4 that he did according to his will. We were talking earlier about the sovereignty of God and the freedom of the human will. God is able to weave things together so that people do what they personally choose to do, and yet God weaves the things together so that providentially things come out in the way that God has designed them. This is similar, I think, to what we have. You're reading through the book of Isaiah, for example, in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 through 7. God said he was going to use Assyria. Assyria was an earlier empire. God was going to use Assyria to discipline his people. Howbeit, he meaneth not so, Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5. In other words, the Assyrian is not attempting to do Jehovah's disciplining of Jehovah's people. The Assyrian doesn't even believe in Jehovah. So the Assyrian doesn't mean it. He's just out fighting imperialistic wars. It is in his heart to cut off nations, not a few, Isaiah 10, 5 through 7 says. But God is using what the Assyrians naturally wanted to do when they acted according to their will, and he's using that to discipline his people. And the same is true here. God, these prophecies are always especially interested in the people of God. That's really the reasons that that were behind these prophecies, the reason that the prophecies were given. So the Medo-Persian Empire, they're going to do according to their will what they choose to do, and yet God will fit that in with his providential care and, in some cases, discipline of his people. All right, let's read verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came up from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. So we have a he-goat in verses 5 through 7. I'll go ahead and read 6 and 7. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler, or bitterness, against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no will, there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. So here we have a he-goat, and again, we have verse 21, so we don't have to guess what it is. Verse 21 says, the rough goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So this he-goat is the Macedonian or the Grecian Empire. Interestingly, this was the bronze section of the image back in chapter 2, and bronze goats have actually been found as the symbol of Macedonia. So you got both the bronze from chapter 2 and the goat from chapter 8 in that symbolic goat that has been found. There's been more than one of them found. He didn't touch the ground. This again is indicative of his speed. Just like the leopard in chapter 7 had double wings on the back of it, indicative of its speed. Here the touching not the ground indicates the speed. So we have different symbolism, but the same point being made. It was said that the speed of Alexander's movement, and Alexander is the first king here that's talked about, the one commonly known as Alexander the Great. It said that the speed of Alexander's movement was worth having an extra army because he could move from place to place so quickly. It seemed like, they said at the time, that it seems like it's almost supernatural how rapidly this army moves. And remember, Daniel seeing this like a motion picture, like you'd see at Worlds of Fun or Disneyland with a surround, round screens all around him. He's seeing it as if it's really happening, and he sees it moves like it's not even touching the ground. So this notable horn is Alexander the Great. The notable horn is said to be the first king in verse 21, which we just read. It's horn between the eyes, and the horn again is the symbol of power. That's Alexandria. Alexander, because all the power of Greece was concentrated in him. His father, Philip of Macedon, died in 336 B.C., and Alexander, at the age of 20, took over at that time. So in verses 6 and 7, Alexander rams the ram. In choler, King James, or bitterness, the original word is marar, M-A-R-A-R. It's the word that Naomi said she should be called. Naomi means pleasant, but in the book of Ruth, remember, after her sons die and so forth, she said that I'm no more going to be called pleasant, but I'll be called bitter. Mara, M-A-R-A. That's the word here for this choler or bitterness that caused Alexander to ram the ram. Alexander invaded Persia. He never thought of not doing it. He was a warrior from his youth. It was his inheritance to do this. Adventure attracted Alexander, and every step forward seemed to lead inevitably to the next step for Alexander. He was never going to stop until he was stopped. So he broke the power of the Medo-Persian Empire. He did it in a number of ways, any way that he could. The Battle of Marathon on the land, the Battle of Salamis on the sea, any way he could, he took over more and more. God determines the times before appointed and the bounds of the habitations of nations. This is what Paul said on Mars Hill in Acts 17. And it really is true. The providential will of God is involved in the rise and fall of nations. We don't know very much about it, not near as much as we'd like to, but we know that the providence of God operates. Alexander the Great made war as few people have ever made war. He swept through Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, Mesopotamia, and all the way over to India in only 12 years. This is an amazing thing. No man since has possessed so unquestionably the strongest power on earth. He possessed such a strenuous energy of both spirit and body that near the end of his life, and he was still only in his 30s, but near the end of his life, when his body was half worn out with the rigors and the wounds of war, his mind could still usually make his body do what he wanted it to do. He had a will of iron. Let me give you just one example of Alexander's will. And I'll contrast this with Nebuchadnezzar, who had quite a will of his own too. But when Nebuchadnezzar came to the city of Tyre, on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, just north of Israel, the people of Tyre went out onto the island of Tyre, a half mile out into the Mediterranean Sea. Nebuchadnezzar besieged Tyre for 13 years, but couldn't take it. And Nebuchadnezzar eventually left Tyre with an indecisive conclusion at best. But when Alexander came to Tyre 250 years later, he scraped the mainland city down to the bedrock and used all that to build a causeway. He scraped the old city down to the bedrock and built a causeway out to the island city. And then he endured everything the people of Tyre could throw at him, which was a lot, by land and by sea, until he took the island city of Tyre, which Nebuchadnezzar was never able to figure out how to do. Alexander did it because he wouldn't take no. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He persevered through everything. Many people in his time thought that he must be divinely inspired to accomplish the things that he did. His subjugation of the world was the most thorough and the most rapid that humanity had ever witnessed. The only thing Alexander's will was inadequate in was his control of his temper. He was not always able to control that. And when he occasionally lost his temper, we get a fearful glimpse into the wild beast that was within him. And it also gives a glimpse into the power of his will, because he usually could control even his temper. He had a beast chained up inside of himself. Wherever it came from, I don't know. But he usually could control it. Bottom line is, he was a great general, equal to almost any test. He met every opponent with different but appropriate tactics. It's as if he was just made for war, and he knew what he was doing in war. He campaigned in winter, which most armies did not do. He pressed the pursuit to the utmost. He never put anything off. He shaved his beard. One of the lasting legacies of Alexander the Great is the shaved male face, because most men wore beards at that time, but Alexander said, I'm not wearing a beard. One of my opponents can grab a hold of that and have control of me. I'm not going to give him anything to grab. So he was all about war, everything about him down to his personal habits. And he showed a tremendously high degree of organizational ability. Perfect success invariably always looks easy, but no lesser man could have done what Alexander did. Chris, were you going to say something? Okay. Alexander was one of the great city builders of all time. 16 Alexandrias we are certain of. There's another one which is almost certain, and a couple more Alexanders are possible, but 16 of them we know for sure. Because when he went and conquered places, he would build them up and call them Alexandria after himself. And the cities he built radiated Greek culture throughout Asia. Well, we've come to the end again. We're right in the middle of a thought, but we'll just try to take it up at that point next week. You have any further questions, comments, or anything to make here? There's a reason for going into this historical background, and unfortunately we'll need a little more historical background next time when we come to the little horn. There's another little horn here in chapter 8, but this little horn comes out of the third beast rather than the fourth, so the identity will be different, but we've got another little horn that is pretty much as remarkable as the little horn was in chapter 7 in its own way. Bill, I think it's time for the announcements.